This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. This past Sunday, Italians rejected some constitutional reforms aimed at solving some serious problems, economic and political problems facing Italy. Some people are saying that this throws Italy's entire relationship with the European Union into question. It's bringing some major issues facing the EU right to the boiling point. Of course, Italy is a central nation in this European unification project. We're going to talk about what this means for Italy and for the EU, so a really fascinating development there. Algeria is another country in crisis. This northern African nation has had serious problems with terrorism, and now the nation's president, who was holding radical Islamic forces in check to some degree, he's practically disappeared. His health is terrible. He's not making any public appearances. This is a very strategically important country right on the Mediterranean, just near Europe, and Europeans are very concerned that what happened in Libya after Muammar Gaddafi was ousted could be repeated in Algeria. We'll talk about the ramifications of this country being on the brink. Fidel Castro's death inspired some kind words from a number of leaders who revealed their affinity for the radical communist leader. Among them was a political firebrand in South Africa named Julius Malema. He leads a political party there that wants to use Castro's Cuba as a model for South Africa. I'll conclude the program today by talking about how to not be offended. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Italy is in big trouble. It's facing economic disaster. Its political system is practically broken and unable to effectively address the problems. Well, this week, Italy held an important referendum on some constitutional reforms. These were supposed to make Italy's political system functional. It was supposed to make economic reform possible. The Italian prime minister staked his political future on the passage of these reforms. But Italians said no. They voted it down by about 60%, so he immediately resigned. Well, what does this mean for Italy going forward and for the EU, the European Union? To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So how big was this? What sort of earthquake does this create for Italians to vote this way?
Well, I think earthquake is an interesting metaphor. It's a bit like, you know, California. Everyone knows that there's going to be a major earthquake at some point. It's just when it will hit. The situation in Italy, it's a bit like if you get distilled water and put it into a microwave, you can get it beyond boiling point without it boiling. But as soon as you disturb it enough or put something in it, all that water just suddenly boils over all at once and explodes in your face. And that's kind of Italy right now. All the ingredients for an explosion are there. And then every time something like this happens, where you have a major political or a major economic upset, people kind of hold their breaths to see, is this the thing that makes Italy explode? And this election, it was one potential trigger, but then it also opens up a whole load of other potential triggers down the road that could cause this explosion to really just blow up in Europe's face.
Well, so let's talk about some of the problems that Italy is facing that they were trying to address with these constitutional changes, how they were going to solve those things.
Right. Italy really has two core problems. One problem is definitely the euro. Italy used to have a competitive economy before it was part of the euro. It's locked in this system at a perpetual disadvantage to Germany. However, Italy has its own very long-standing problems. It's gotten a little better recently, but if you look at Italy since World War II, it's almost had a new prime minister on average every year or two. The political turmoil is huge. The political system was designed after Mussolini, where you had a strong man, but it has meant that it's very hard to get any reform going. And really, since the 90s, Italy's economy has been stagnating, has been having problems. And because of this dysfunctional political system that just keeps cycling through different leaders and stops anything to happen, they've never been able to address their own economic problems either. So you do have this kind of dysfunctional economic system, and Matteo Renzi wanted to fix that with these constitutional reforms. To be frank, I've got no idea whether or not these constitutional reforms themselves would have been the best or would have been a solution for that. I mean, that's obviously just a debate for the Italians, and I kind of left that to one side. But there is absolutely a political problem that has caused major economic problems within Italy, and then the euro has just compounded that.
So how does Italians voting this down, is this basically like, what's the plan B now? How are we going to address these things? Is that why this vote kind of poses such a challenge to Italians?
I think the reason why the vote is significant is just because I think how bad everything is in Italy. So we've talked before on this program how they've got youth unemployment of 40%, so nearly half of all teen or young people aged 18 to 25 looking for work cannot find a job. Unemployment is 12% compared to about 4.5% in Germany. You've got 17% of all the loans by Italian banks not being paid back. That's 360 billion. And it's these banks that really pose some of the biggest immediate threat to the economy. The Telegraph's international business editor, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he wrote that the contours are worse than the 1930s. It is a lost decade turning into a second lost decade. No large developed country in modern times has ever suffered such a fate. So Italy's got shaky banks. Economic fundamentals are horrible. And so anytime you have these political upheavals, people start worrying about the banks. And just, for example, the oldest bank in the world, the Banco di Monte Paschi that we've spoken about again before, they were trying to raise funds this week. So there's now some big uncertainty. I think it's Thursday now. They're going to try and raise some funds. So there's some uncertainty now as to whether this referendum could directly affect the solvency of this particular bank. If that bank goes into trouble, then there's question marks about all the other banks. Then there's question marks as to how that would affect the savings of ordinary Italians. And so it's just a case of, well, is this going to be the event that starts all these dominoes falling?
And how much does, say, the resignation of the prime minister after his failure in this referendum play into that and kind of enhance the chaos?
Well, firstly, you've just got the question marks, the lack of confidence. Businesses don't like uncertainty. The second very direct way is that in the immediate aftermath of the vote and the resignation to stabilize things, the European Central Bank bought a whole ton of Italian government debt. Now, the way the euro is set up, the European Central Bank is limited in the amount of Italian debt it is allowed to buy without Italy being in a bailout program. So they just used up a whole ton of their ammunition. And so now the question is, well, what's next? If there's another crisis, for example, Italy has a whole load more debt that they need to roll over in February. Is the European Central Bank now out of ammunition? So could that make things worse for Italy? And then the third aspect that is probably the most significant is then that coming up now, waiting in the wings on Italian politics is Beppe Grillo and the Five Star Movement that want Italy out of the euro. They are a party that has come from almost nowhere. They were founded just very recently, and they want to completely upend it. They see that the euro is a cause of a lot of Italy's problems, and they want to bring Italy out of the euro. Now, that, I think there's a good case that would be the only long-term problem or one long-term solution to a lot of Italy's problems, but would be a huge amount of short-term turmoil and would be devastating, especially in that short term, not just for Italy, but for the whole eurozone and especially for Germany. And so the possibility now of these populists coming up is something that is a big issue for Italy. And that's something they don't really have any solution to. How do you stop these guys? They could do what they've done before and kind of go with a technocratic European government. But then if you do that in the long term, you're just going to push even more people towards this Eurosceptic backlash. So that's the other aspect that is really standing out from this vote.
Yeah, maybe you could you mentioned dominoes falling. If this might be the crisis that causes the whole thing to begin to cascade, and I guess really Italy's relationship to the European Union and its standing within that union is probably one of the biggest dominoes that's in question right now. Maybe you could talk about other dominoes that might fall. And also, if I could just throw in, maybe you could just remind our listeners about who we're talking about with Beppe Grillo.
Right. So Beppe Grillo is, I'll start with that because he's a former comedian. Decided that he was going to turn political, and it was especially around the time of Mario Monti, a technocrat enforced into Italy essentially by a European Union coup. And so the Beppe Grillo and the Five Star Movement are against the EU, against the euro, but then they're also kind of a direct democracy movement. They're quite a young movement. Some of their leaders are, or some of the parliamentarians are, only in their 20s. And they came second last time around in elections. I think polls put them neck on neck for first. So they're the upcoming force in Italian politics.
So this is really like another major illustration of this trend that you've been writing about and talking about. We've had several discussions on the program about the rise in populist leaders and sort of anti-establishment leaders that we see happening in Europe and really all over the world.
Right. But then the point to get back to those other points, is that we're seeing this in Italy. And Italy, you know, it's not Greece, it's not Portugal, it's not even Spain that didn't join the European Union. Spain didn't until relatively recently. This is, it's Italy. This is a G7 economy. It is Germany could relatively easily bail out Greece and take care of Greece's debts. Italy's debts are on a completely different scale. And so if you have some kind of crisis involving Italian government debt, this is something that brings the euro crisis to a much bigger level. This is something that even Germany would not be able to take care of without some just revolutionary changes. So that debt alone puts Italy in a separate category in the size of its economy. But then, of course, the Treaty of Rome is one of the most fundamental treaties of the European Union, signed in Italy. This is one of the central European nations. And so just to have Euroscepticism in a country so central to the EU has got to be shaking European leaders up. And it is shaking European leaders up already. Now, if you start getting them into power, well, that's, you know, Britain leaving the European Union, well, that's one thing. Britain has been on the outskirts, has been kind of against integration all along. If you start to get the prospect of Italy leaving the European Union, we saw how people were starting to ask, is the European Union doomed? Is it going to fall apart after Brexit? I mean, what would people be thinking once if Italy starts to approach that situation?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating development. And for anybody who's been reading The Trumpet, listening to Trumpet Radio for any length of time, they know that European integration is one of the pillar prophecies that we refer to time and time again, and the Union of Ten Kings. And like you said, Italy really seems to be at the heart of the integration that we are expecting, particularly since that's where the Vatican is. Just looking at this prophetically, how does the kind of turmoil and tumult that we see happening in Italy today, how might this play out in a way that would be consistent with prophecy?
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to watch. I mean, I doubt we could be 100. I mean, maybe we can't be 100% certain, but it seems almost certain that Italy would be one of those 10 kings, would be part of that core European Union, given its history, given the role of the Catholic Church and the Vatican there in Rome, as you mentioned. So to me, the most logical way for this to tie into Bible prophecy is just to force things to a crisis, to force things to a point where Europe, and where especially Germany, says we need to rethink things. This kind of hobbling along the way that we've done now, coming up with one sticking plaster after another, one just kind of ad hoc solution after another, this very gradual drift towards a super state isn't enough. We need to take some massive steps now. Because Europe has been, they've been trying to avoid really concentrating on this problem. They've just been in denial. They've just not wanted to face it. A crisis in Italy would force them to face it. And I think you could see some of these groups like Beppe Grillo and the Five Star Movement, like the National Front in France, that are similar in that they want France out of the euro. You could see some of these groups, or at least a large segment of their supporters, once the European Union starts getting serious, once the European Union starts responding to their concerns about immigration, for example, because anti-immigration has been a major part of this referendum as well. Mm-hmm. Italy has been on the front lines of immigration into Europe from Africa. They don't like the EU's open immigration policy. But once the European Union starts turning some of these things around, starts getting really serious, starts perhaps getting serious on defense, when it's very clear that being part of the European Union is going to enhance your nation's power, that kind of, and then once the Catholic Church, as we've been forecasting, and as Mr. McDonald spoke about on the Trumpet Daily Radio show yesterday, once the Catholic Church starts really getting behind the European Union, and a lot of these movements are, especially with the National Fronts in France, are supported by Catholics, you could see that changing. And these people, once the European Union has changed, abandoning their opposition to the European Union. So I think, to me, the biggest way that this would move prophecy forward, whether this is the big crisis or whether the big crisis is going to come when Italy holds their elections, maybe in 6 months' time or later, potentially even up until 2018. But whenever that crisis comes, that crisis is going to force Europe to finally face this crisis, because it will be so big that it's just unavoidable.
That is definitely something that we need to keep our eyes on. You could see how this kind of you could see how it would force European leaders to say this is enough of this kind of wishy-washy leadership. We really need to stand up and do something, because the whole project is in jeopardy. You do wonder, and we've talked about this over the years, whether it will be, you know, how viable the euro is, for example, going forward, if that's actually something that's going to last, and even the European Union itself, whether there would be some other combination or some other political entity that would rise to take its place, or whether somehow or other they would actually preserve what they've built in the European Union itself. It seems to me like these kinds of existential type questions of exactly what Europe is going to look like in the years ahead, these are really on the table right now.
I agree. I think that's a great point. I'm not sure how likely it is, but I think you're right. It is possible that Italy could say leave the euro and then still end up being part of those 10 kings as something is built from the ashes of this project. And that certainly would be a crisis of significant or enough magnitude to get them really focused on this problem. So not a huge amount, I guess, that we can say for sure, but we can definitely see the way things are going, and we definitely know where they're going to arrive from Bible prophecy. So we can see a lot of the general outlines as we watch it unfold.
Fascinating stuff. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this political crisis in Italy, an economic crisis. He's written an article called "Italian Referendum: Is This the Big One?" You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks a lot, Richard.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Northern African nation of Algeria has suffered a lot of terrorism. Recent United Nations statistics show that it's the Arab nation's second hardest hit by terrorism over the past 40 years, and the problem could be about to get worse. The Algerian president is nearly 80, and he's battling several health issues, and in some ways he's been a major force preventing Islamic extremists from having even more success. What happens in Algeria could have significant ramifications far beyond the borders of this country. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Callum Wood here via Skype from Australia. Hello, Callum.
Hello, sir. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you. So I want to start by talking about Algeria's 10-year civil war. This war went on from 1991 to 2001. This war gives us an idea of the battle lines that we see between the Algerian government and the radical Islamists. Maybe you could just tell us about that.
Yes, well, like you mentioned, there was this civil war that it was a showdown between the government and radical Islamists. We often tend to think of radical Islam as being predominantly Middle Eastern, but it does extend certainly across North Africa and definitely into Algeria. And we had a very bloody civil war. There was well over 100,000 people killed, numerous cases of abductions, rapes, and so on. And it was a really dark time in their history. And yes, this was a time when the government came to the brink of collapse because of radical Islam infiltrating the country and managing to stir up enough public support and dissent that they were able to, yes, start a civil war, and it led to a massive death toll in the nation and, almost brought it to the brink of collapse.
So it gives you an idea of the stakes and the actors at play here and how much radical Islamists are bent on trying to take over that country.
Very much so. And while the radical Islamists were considered the losers in that civil war, they didn't come out on top, and a strong hardline government has since been established. They certainly haven't gone away by any means. Even today, a large percentage of the women in Algeria do wear the full headscarf or the burqa. And we certainly know that in neighboring countries like Libya, the Islamists have had major success, a huge success since the toppling of the strong man there. And no doubt they look at Egypt, they look at Libya, and they see that when a strong leader is removed, that there's so much more opportunity to destabilize the nation. It becomes a very fertile ground for Islamists to thrive. And so while they did lose in that very dark time, the Black Decade, as that civil war was called, while they did lose, they certainly weren't defeated in the long term. And we can see now that as the ailing president he's showing himself less and less in the public. And we can see that the Islamists are looking at this and no doubt thinking, wow, what a great opportunity we have here to recreate perhaps what we've seen in Egypt or Libya.
Yeah, well, let's talk about him, President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. He's been criticized by some for being heavy-handed, but there are definitely people who are saying if this guy goes, as far as Islamic terrorism goes, things could really go from bad to worse here.
That's right. He is very heavy-handed. We've seen that in examples such as when there was the hostage situation at the oil refinery there in Algeria a few years ago. We saw a lot of the hostages killed in that incident because the government just charged in guns blazing. And while a lot of these sort of actions are condemned by the international community, at the same time, the question has to be asked, if they didn't have a strong leader in there, how much worse would it be at this moment? It speaks to how unstable the region really is and how persistent these Islamists are, that even with a strong leader in the country, they've been able to carry out attacks and keep putting pressure on the government. But it would be much, much worse if you didn't have a leader who was willing to take a firm stance. We can see that that's proved in Libya right next door.
Right.
We had Gaddafi right there, and he was certainly very, very strong. He ruled the nation with an iron fist, not condoning his actions by any means. But again, as soon as he was removed, instability was just fostered and the Islamists were able to gain the high ground.
Yeah, you really could just see something of a repeat happening, exactly what happened in Libya taking place right in Algeria. Similar circumstances, similar forces at work, similar strongman type government in place. You take that out and what fills the void. So tell us about other factors that exacerbate the problems in Algeria and that make it a volatile place right now.
Well, right now we know that oil prices around the world are at a low, and that's really what keeps Algeria going is oil. A lot of the nation is uninhabited. It's desert. It's very dry and arid. In the southern parts of the country, for instance, there's not a great deal of people, but what there is plenty of oil. And because that's the mainstay for Algeria, it's what keeps them going. It's what fuels their economy. When you take such a big hit like you have at the moment with prices, Well, that's really crippling the government's ability to put funds towards its military, to guarding its borders. Algeria is known to have very, very porous borders simply because there's so much expanse of desert. It's very hard to patrol that. It takes a lot of military effort and it takes a lot of money. And right now, money is not something that Algeria has. The oil's not selling for what it used to. And one of their biggest clients, the United States, is now using its own oil, and so they've lost that client as well. It's a double hit for them. Lower prices and they've lost the American client means that less money is coming into Algeria, and so you have less opportunity for the government to start programs, to fund its military, to be more aggressive against pushing back against these Islamists. And at the same, so you have poverty at the same time, public dissent. People are unhappy. They looked back at the Arab Spring, and people wanted change. We know a lot of the young people drove a lot of the protests in the early days of the Arab Spring in Egypt and elsewhere, and they were honestly looking for change. And you do have to feel for some of these people. They look around and they see prospering nations elsewhere, and they want the same thing. And of course, the Arab Spring was the big hope for quite a few Arabs. And when that was hijacked by radicals, as it was, and we've failed to see the benefits come from it, no doubt people are unhappy. And so that's why we're looking down the barrel of Arab Spring 2.0, you might say. And in Algeria, that would certainly be the case at the moment, with so much poverty, low education, destabilized area. It looks ripe for civil unrest.
Really, you could almost see President Bouteflika's health being sort of an analogy for the feebleness of the government in general and its vulnerability to upheaval.
That's right. And he's shown himself less and less, as I mentioned earlier. In the last presidential campaign, he didn't even go out and see the people. He didn't go campaigning because he was in such bad health. Yet he still managed to win. So he obviously maintained some rapport amongst the people, but the less he shows his face now, and certainly if he's not responding to the questions of the people or the needs of the people, then he's going to lose that popularity really quickly. And certainly as his health's collapsing as well, we know that he might not even make it to the next election. Health-wise, he might have to resign, and that's when we'd see this dangerous time of transition.
But in some ways, the problems besieging Algeria go beyond just whether or not one man remains in power there. There's just a whole lot of factors that seem to be conspiring to create something of a tinderbox in this area. And you have to think that other nations would be concerned, just looking at a map of the area there. It's just right across the Mediterranean that you're into Europe. It's very close to Spain and to France. What are some of the factors that would really be concerning as Europe is watching what's going on here, having already dealt with similar circumstances in Libya?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head there. It's Europe that's going to be chiefly concerned with this unrest in Algeria. The last thing that Europe needs right now is more migrants coming in, more refugees flooding in. And at the moment, Algeria really hasn't supplied a great deal of those. A lot of them the African migrants, that is, have come up from over towards the east further. We've seen a lot of migrants certainly come through Libya. But now, if Algeria is also plunged into chaos, if their transition between presidents doesn't go smoothly, if the Islamists do manage to get a foothold, then we could see the nation descend into civil war again, and you would see a huge influx of refugees come from Algeria. There have been reports where expecting, some say, more than 1 million refugees flood across the Mediterranean. And because of its history with the nation, France would likely take the brunt of that. And, of course, that would only enrage the French populace more, no doubt. It would give more political support to Marine Le Pen's right-wing political party, the National Front. And of course, this French party, if it gets any more popular than it is now, it could certainly claim power in France. And if they do, they've promised to hold a referendum on leaving the EU. So that's obviously further down the track. But it's easy to see how Algeria could really start some dominoes falling in Europe and could really lead to serious strain on the European Union, simply because it has so many people that could flood across from the Mediterranean if things start to get bad.
Now, this whole situation in Algeria, this is something that the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, Gerald Fleury, has written about, and he talked about how Algeria has actually, in recent years, become a battleground between Europe and these forces of radicalism. Maybe you can just put this in the context of the forecasts that he has made about it and what the Bible says about it.
Well, Mr. Fleury, he wrote that article entitled Watch Algeria. And in that, Mr. Fleury points to this looming confrontation between these two powers, the King of the North and the King of the South, that we read about there in Daniel 11. And
this was 2012 that he wrote that article, right? That's right.
That was before things started to really destabilize in the nation even further. Bouteflika's health has only gone down since then. He's spent less time on the public scene. The Islamists while they haven't had any high-profile attacks like they did back then, Mr. Fleury wrote that article, and it was just after that attack on the oil refinery where all those hostages were killed. While there hasn't been any of those high-profile attacks, certainly unrest is simmering beneath the surface. And, of course, we're now down the road. We're a couple of years closer to Bouteflika's either resignation from office or the transition of power. But it's, as I mentioned, it's all in the context of Daniel 11 and the King of the North versus the King of the South in this showdown between these big world powers. And for years now, we at The Trumpet have discussed the identity of these two powers. We have plenty of books and booklets on The Trumpet website that you can request and read about these. The chief ones, of course, being the King of the South. That would be an excellent one to read about. But basically, that goes through and proves the identity of the King of the South as Iran. And we know Iran is, since Mr. Fleury wrote that article, they've been majorly empowered. They have a huge amount of cash to spend. They're already the world's chief sponsor of terrorism. Well, now we can see they can do even more than they were back then. And no doubt Algeria is in their sights. You only have to look at a map and see the unrest that was fostered in Egypt, then in Libya. And who's right on the doorstep? Next up is Algeria. It's just a natural progression along that northern Arabic coastline of Africa. Algeria's next in the crosshairs, so where better for these two powers to collide? I mean, Europe cannot allow Algeria to fall. They can't allow it to descend into chaos simply for the threat of the migrants that could spill over into Europe. And so Europe really does have to stop Iran's spreading of radical Islam, and Algeria is the place. It's where these two great powers are colliding.
Well, we sure appreciate you bringing that report to us. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Callum Wood about potential serious unrest in Algeria and how this is really turning into a crisis point, something that Europe is certainly concerned about, certainly that Algerians are very concerned about as they see the prospect of another civil war erupting there. He's written an article called Looming Crisis in Algeria. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Callum, we appreciate you bringing this story to our attention.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We've heard a lot about leaders praising Fidel Castro since his death a week and a half ago. One leader you might not have heard of is the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters political party in South Africa, Julius Malema. This man really wants to use Cuba as a model for what to do in South Africa. And he's had a lot of good things to say about Castro and his legacy. To talk about this, I have trumpet writer Anthony Chibaderwe. Hello, Anthony.
Hello.
So Julius Malema, he's not in power. He's not necessarily a household name. How significant is what Malema says?
As you said, that Julius Malema is the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party in South Africa. It's a party that was established, I believe, in 2012. And this was after Julius Malema was fired from the ANC, the African National Congress. This is the ruling party in South Africa, very big party. In the last elections in South Africa, it attained about 60% of the vote. Mm-hmm. It has been in power since 1994.
So they fired him.
They fired him.
So and he started this new party.
He started his new party. He was very influential in the ANC. He was the youth. He was the leader of the youth league in the ANC, which itself is a radical party. But then the ANC thought that Malema was just way too radical, so they fired him. And yet, soon after that, he founded his own party that managed to secure 6% of the vote in 2014. So that's how significant Malema is. 6% as compared to 60-some percent, that's a huge difference, yes. But when you consider that this is a guy who was fired from the ruling party, and now his party is the third largest party in South Africa, that's significant. That means that every word that Malema speaks is significant, and people ought to pay attention to what he says, because he does mean what he says.
So 6% political support, how much do his views, well, first of all, let's just talk about his views. What is he saying about Castro? How closely do his political views align with Castro?
What he says is that South Africa should become like Cuba. He wants to run South Africa like Cuba. Should he get into power? And that's essentially a view that most African countries have, actually. If you look at Zimbabwe, for example, it received a lot of support when Zimbabwe was fighting for independence from Britain. It received a lot of support from Cuba. Same thing in South Africa. And Malema said that in a recent memorial service for Castro. He said that a lot of African countries owe it to Fidel Castro. And he wants South Africa to become a lot more communist. He wants to lead South Africa like Castro did.
So any specific policies or reforms that he'd like to implement that he sees Cuba as serving as a model for?
Probably the biggest thing would be land and natural resources in the nation, and businesses, especially foreign-owned businesses, or even businesses owned by white people. He believes that white people in South Africa do not belong there. He believes that black people have been disadvantaged, and he believes that that land, that property, those businesses, those mines, which have contributed a lot to the South African economy, he believes that they should be repossessed by the government and given to poor people. Given to black people. That's his big and campaign slogan, essentially. And he's copying Zimbabwe's example, and he's not stopping.
So we've talked quite a bit about just how much racial tensions have increased in the United States. In a lot of ways, Malema, he's really known for his views on race in South Africa. How radical are his views? I mean, you're talking about repossessing land, basically stripping whites of property and reassigning it to blacks. And this is a pretty extreme. And to some degree, that has actually happened policy-wise in South Africa. he wants it to go even further than what it has gone.
Yes. Like I said before, a lot of African countries already had some of these pro-Castro views. He has been criticizing the present government for not representing those values enough. In fact, he even criticized the government and said that you don't even have a right to mourn Fidel Castro because you haven't been doing this well enough. Some of the radical things he has said is that Black people in South Africa are unemployed because of white people. He said this is a quote, "We are dying because of them. We are illiterate because of them. We have suffered to drugs because of them." And he says that white people owe Black people a lot because of that. He says that we need to take the land. We need to take land. If you like it, go get it. He has said that. And he's gotten in trouble for it. Recently, he was, November 7th, he was in court for some of these radical statements that he had made in the past. So he appeared in court for that. And what he did is that instead of repenting, he actually challenged the law.
Let's just step back a little bit and look at the bigger picture in South Africa. Obviously, you know, the problems that you're talking about with race relations in the country, these have been plaguing South Africa for quite some time, but they also represent, there was a certain level of prosperity that the country enjoyed that those problems have, it's gotten quite a bit worse conditions in a lot of ways, say since the end of apartheid and what's happened in that country under Jacob Zuma and the current leadership. Maybe you could just give us an overview of what's happening in the country.
South Africa is one of the most prosperous countries in Africa. In fact, it has been the biggest economy in Africa for the longest time, until very recently when Nigeria overtook it. But South Africa has been the most prosperous country in Africa, and it has been providing a lot of goods, a lot of food, a lot of employment, even for many people. There have been a lot of people flocking to South Africa just to find employment or better employment because it was more prosperous. More people found better jobs in South Africa than in their home countries. So there's been a lot of that. But then because of a lot of the problems, especially with the politics and some of the social problems in South Africa, things have been deteriorating. You have all these politicians talking about taking land from white farmers, taking businesses from white people, following the Zimbabwean model, following communist principles, that type of thing. These things have had the effect of the closure of businesses. Farmland is no longer as productive as it used to be.
You take it from someone who knows how to farm and you give it to someone who doesn't, and productivity is going to drop.
Certainly, because you have all these people who now have who are unemployed, and all they really want is money and food. And you tell them as a politician, as a corrupt politician like Malema, you tell them that, hey, I have a solution for you. Just grab that white man's farm and that will solve everything. A lot of people buy that. They buy into that, but they don't realize that it takes a lot more to produce food. It takes a lot of experience. It takes a lot of machinery and equipment to do that, and to do that on a large scale for the whole country, not just for you and your family and maybe your extended family, which is what that ordinary individual is mostly thinking about, because this is someone who just wants a job and you tell them, hey, why don't you take over a commercial farm that was providing food for the whole country? Mm-hmm. So that's the problem that you've had in South Africa. And you've had a lot of mines that have been shutting down because of a lot of problems, a lot of problems that stemmed from an economy that has been deteriorating because of a lot of these problems. A lot of people are leaving South Africa. So things have not been going very well in South Africa, even though this country has a lot of potential. It has some of the largest deposits of gold, of platinum, of diamonds in the whole world.
Yeah.
And yet there is little to show for that right now.
Yeah, it's interesting to, I guess that we've seen these pictures that have come out with Castro arm in arm with Nelson Mandela. And we have, a leader like Julius Malema who's looking at Cuba and saying, well, this would really be a good model for us to follow. That sort of patina of positivity that people see, looking at the end of apartheid as a real success story, it's just interesting how shallow that really is. There are, you look at, say, something like Cuba and say, well, this was a real success story because of its education, because of its healthcare. But what about all of the problems that were associated with it? What about all of the oppression? What about all of the political assassinations and political killings that went on, and all of the prisoners and all of the people who were trying to escape? There are just so many things about what has happened there that really should serve as a warning to anybody who wants to use the positive side as a model. Really, you could look at South Africa in a similar way and just say, well, okay, let's look at the whole picture rather than just focusing on this one success that was scored. Look at, well, what lessons can we take from that? And human beings just seem to be very, very good at ignoring those larger lessons and just focusing on the very small thing that they consider as a positive takeaway from it. You certainly see that in the way that Malema is looking at Cuba. But in a lot of ways, it seems like the problems that are happening in South Africa, even looking at just the problems associated with race relations in South Africa, you have leaders in the United States who really view South Africa as a model in terms of the way that they want to go about trying to seek racial justice and ignore the killings and ignore the way that has really exploded in violence in a lot of cases. That's a real problem. I mean, I really do see South Africa in some ways as giving us a picture of where the United States is headed in certain areas.
And Julius Malema seems to be just the perfect embodiment of that type of thinking, that type of revolutionary thinking, because, like I said, he has been in the ANC, and right now what he's telling his supporters is that, look, the ANC has been trying, but it hasn't been trying hard enough. We have given them so much time to do this. We have given them so much time to give land back to the black South Africans, and they haven't done it, or it hasn't been working. So it seems like Malema's ideology is that we just have to have a revolution. We just have to take it to a whole new level. Mm-hmm. to make something that hasn't been working work.
Right. Not the right lesson to take from what's happened there. We've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chibadwe about South Africa's Julius Malema. He's written an article called The Abundance of Julius Malema's Heart. You can read that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate you coming in, Anthony.
Good to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
In our world today, people are taking offense at a lot of things. They're allowing themselves to be ruled by negative emotions. Last week in this time, I talked about just how important emotions are and how we need to control them and to use them to our advantage rather than letting them control us. Well, I want to give you a bit of Bible-based advice on how to avoid being offended, how to overcome offense, and how to govern your emotions in this way. Probably the best single verse about this is Psalm 119, verse 165. It says, "Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them." This is fantastic advice. This is how to avoid being caught in the trap of being offended. It says, love God's law. Follow that outflowing law of love. Now, what does God's love look like? You can see the answer to that question in 1 Corinthians 13. It says, love is very patient. It's very kind. Love knows no jealousy. Love makes no parade. It gives itself no airs. It's never rude, never selfish, never irritated. That's the way the Moffat translation reads in that passage. Now, if you contrast the love that's being described in that passage with self-love, you can see just how much the opposite they really are. Self-love can be very impatient. It's very easily provoked. It can be very rude. It can be selfish. God's love is none of those things. Obeying that law of love helps you to remain calm and stable and unoffended. Submitting to God means always loving the other person. And it also helps to make you more compassionate. You have a clearer perspective on your own faults, and then that helps you to recognize your own contributions to interpersonal conflicts. It makes you a lot less judgmental toward others' struggles. Matthew 5, verses 38 through 44 give this advice. Resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue you at the law and take away your coat, let him have your cloak also. You've heard that it has been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And incidentally, that's not from God's law. That was just something that people were saying, and it's very contrary to God's law in the Old Testament. Christ said, I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, and do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Now, is it difficult to do that? Of course it is. It's absolutely opposite the spirit of this world and the things that we naturally tend to do in response to provocation. But the power to choose your own reaction is completely under your control. If you have that take no offense attitude, then if you get a nasty email or a cold look or a criticism, that's not going to hurt you. If people come after you, that's not going to provoke you. You're going to be bulletproof to that kind of an attack, because your strength doesn't come from self-righteousness, which is very vulnerable and very susceptible to being provoked. It comes from God and his law of love. Jesus Christ was mocked. He was ridiculed and beaten, tortured, crucified. But how did he respond? He prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's the absolute opposite of the hypersensitive, vindictive attitude that this world is deliberately cultivating in people, that you see on college campuses, you see in politics, and you see more and more in society today, that is absolutely ripping our society apart. How do you respond to slights and insults? Do you think like Jesus Christ, or do you think like the devil? How much have you mastered your emotions? Are you easily offended? Are you prone to emotional outbursts over small issues? Are your emotions immature and harmful? Are they founded on reality, or are they based on assumptions and misperceptions and lies? We all need to monitor and to regulate our responses to what happens in our lives. We have to develop real awareness of our own emotions and become attuned to what's going on in our own mind in order to identify what's causing our emotion and to recognize when we're getting emotional in a destructive way. More rock-solid advice can be found in Proverbs 14:29. It says, he that is slow to wrath is of great understanding, But he that is hasty of spirit or quick-tempered exalts folly. Mastering your emotions is, it's not just about being slow to wrath. It's also about cultivating and using right emotion. You can read in Philippians 4 where it says, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things." This is something to go after and to set your mind on that will really go a long way to helping you to control your emotions and to set them on a right course. In stark contrast to self-love, God's love is never glad when others go wrong. Love is gladdened by goodness, always slow to expose, always eager to believe the best, always hopeful, always patient. That's what 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7 says. Now that's a fantastic description of how we need to respond to slights and offenses and problems and conflicts. That's the kind of emotional mastery that we really need to work to develop. That is true emotional maturity. And somebody with godly emotional maturity is able to not only avoid the drastic extremes of emotion that we see in society today, but he can also build a powerful and vivid, meaningful life, growing closer to the creator of emotion. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Callum Wood, and Anthony Chibatadwe. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Benjamin Disraeli. The secret of success in life is for a man to be ready for his opportunity when it comes. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.